Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show. PharmaTalk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to those in life sciences, and in particular drug development, and this, of course, always includes patient advocacy communities. When I'm not working with PharmaTalk Radio, I head up content and direction at the conference forum. For information on event listings and radio listings, please visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Today I'm joined by our marketing manager, Annalee Smith, as we introduce a panel discussion addressing partnering with patient organizations for advancing cures, originally recorded during the 4th annual Patients as Partners U.S. event in March 2017.
Thanks for having me, Val. What I really appreciate about this session is the diversity of our panelist perspectives, and Lori Abrams from BMS really does a fantastic job of moderating.
Yes, she really does. It was great to have an industry perspective engaging directly with patients and patient advocacy groups.
Yeah, so Lori talks here with panelists from the Medical Device Innovation Consortium, the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, the Arthritis Foundation, and the National Kidney Foundation.
So, hi, my name is Lori Abrams, and I head up the Diversity and Patient Engagement team at Bristol-Myers Squibb. And I've been in that role for 5 years. And so just real quickly, we thought we'd tell you a little bit about each of us. My team focuses in clinical trials, in patient engagement in phases 1 to 4 in all therapeutic areas globally. And we focus on bringing the voice of the caregiver, the patient advocacy group or the patient group, the patient, and the study coordinators to every decision that we make in a therapeutic area. And I'll describe a little bit what that looks like in our question and answer period. We focus about 40 or 50% of our time on health disparities, identifying the epidemiology of every disease area that we focus on, every tumor type, whatever the therapeutic area is, and working with diverse and minority-based organizations and faith-based organizations to try to match our patient population with those in the community. And we've been doing that for 5 years also. And then working with patient groups and patients to help them understand what a clinical trial is and find one for them. And we heard a little bit about funding and how you get people from point A to point B. We help find solutions either within Bristol-Myers Squibb or partnering with groups. There are a lot of venture capitalists and others out there that are more than willing to pay to get people from one side of the country and their families to the others. And so we've done a lot of that work over the last 5 years.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. I am Lauren McLaughlin from the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. The organization itself is really focused on funding Parkinson's research. We do a lot of early preclinical funding. Our whole philosophy is to de-risk the field. And so what that means is we will fund very outrageous and early ideas in order to get them into the phase 1, phase 4 clinical trials. We work very closely with industry as well in order to move clinical trials through the entire process. So we do that in a number of different ways, including engaging patients as participants in trials, as well as advocates. We have just moved into the policy space as well in order to really ensure that as soon as therapies go to market, that there is an open environment for them. So working with clinicians in order to understand what new therapies there might be, as well as working on reimbursements. I specifically work on a study called Fox Insight, which is an online observational study, which is hoping to gain a lot of natural history information from patients. So gathering a lot of patient-reported outcomes, PROs, in order to inform and improve the entire clinical design process.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Christopher. I'm from the Medical Device Innovation Consortium. We're a nonprofit public-private partnership working to advance the regulatory science of medical devices. And so what I mean when I say regulatory science, what we're working on is the methods and the tools to advance innovation. So looking at things like how we can do clinical trials more efficiently and more effectively, and how we can work with patients in a scientifically rigorous and meaningful way. And I'm excited to be here today and to be here specifically with Lauren from the Fox Foundation. We have a project that we're working on with the Fox Foundation to integrate patient preferences into the statistical design of clinical trials, which is a really kind of a potentially groundbreaking method for how we go about designing our clinical trials. So that's been a tremendous learning experience for both of our organizations and an ongoing one.
Hi, my name is Nirmala Singh. I'm the former patient engagement director at the National Kidney Foundation. I actually have been working in advocacy for the past 13 years and recently transitioned more into patient education and patient engagement work as a director of patient engagement at Decibel Strategic Group. And what we aim to do is amplify the patient voice. And we do that by working throughout life science industries and working with pharmaceutical companies and patient advocacy groups and learning how to better build those partnerships to create better programs and resources for patients.
Hi, again, I'm Sue Schrant, the Director of Patient Engagement at the Arthritis Foundation. Prior to that role, I actually know some of you from my time at PCORI. I was there for almost 4 years as the Deputy Director of Patient Engagement. So my role at the foundation is really to take all that we built and learned at PCORI and bring it with me over to the Arthritis Foundation. So I'm really sort of developing our patient engagement infrastructure there, and it's been a fun 6 months so far.
Thanks, everyone. So here's the scoop. When we met, and we really met, I didn't know anyone on the panel, and I was really excited about the diverse nature of the team. We decided to just have a few questions and not have each of us answer them. Why is that? I had a feeling by the time we got to this point in the day, many of you would have questions that needed additional explanation, or you would have new questions. Because if you look at the questions in the agenda, we're really talking about the nuts and the bolts now. How does industry partner with advocacy or patient groups, whatever you want to call a group of people that advocate on behalf of patients? So it's the patients and the family members also. So we're going to go through five questions, and then we'd like to open it up for additional questions or discussion from the audience. Sound good? Okay, I see nods, so I'm happy. So I'm going to turn to my two colleagues on the left and ask, how does industry choose which advocacy groups to partner with, or vice versa?
Well, I'll kick things off for us, and of course I've got one key example here, and that's my collaborator here, right here with me. But when we were considering doing this research project, this was really the first kind of project like this that MDIC had undertaken. Where, as I said, we're a public-private partnership, so we're used to working with FDA and with industry, and we had some kind of individual patient advocates within, that were within our circle, but we hadn't actively worked with a patient group in this way before, where they were actively engaged as partners and scientists at the table that were at the investigator meetings. And I think the first thing that we were looking for is we were looking for a group that was ready from day one. We needed a group that was already mobilized, that understood the importance of research in general, and had a large community of patients that were already willing to take part in this sort of research project. And one of the things that we were excited about, in particular with the Fox Foundation, was that they had this Fox Insight program, and as such had a huge database of patients that were already willing to participate in research. So it took that element of, you know, how do we find these patients to partner with? We had a group that was essentially already mobilized, and that made going forward with them really just an easy decision to make.
And so from the other perspective, just we are very honored to work with MDIC and the FDA in order to really gain the patient voice in this entire process. And so changing the way that clinical trials might be powered and designed, how things are ultimately approved. I think from just the foundation perspective, we have such an engaged patient community because we trigger on so many different levels. We definitely try to empower the patients. Everything everything we do is completely transparent. We share back information as readily as we possibly can. We offer many different avenues to be involved, whether it is participating in clinical trials, just general awareness of what clinical trials are and how you might be able to start that process, as well as advocacy and policy engagement, education, so webinars, meetups, in-person, collaborations, fundraising opportunities. And I think just finding people where they are allows them to choose their own adventure as they engage. Find what they're comfortable with, remove a lot of those barriers to entry in order to empower them that they can affect change. We have a very, very strong patient council, and they act like our board members. We touch base with them. They help kind of gut check everything that we do. They inform a lot of our activities just to make sure that we are really grounded in the patient voice, in that perspective, to make sure that we are moving forward in the right directions. And then we connect with scientists and researchers to really go kind of bottom up, as well as try to change the entire field. So not driving forth a specific initiative, a specific objective, but how do you bring collaborators from across many different spectrums to work together to generate new ideas, to bring sparks that might not have been there previously, in order to just kind of change the paradigm that we all operate in.
Does anyone have anything they'd like to add? Okay, so the only thing that I'll say is that given that we're in multiple therapeutic areas, we our team really looks to see which patient groups or advocacy groups has commonalities. So you don't always know that by looking at something on paper. So we have a lot of introductory meetings to find out what's motivating a patient group and where their strengths are and if things line up between us. And, you know, I have a colleague in the back who will be speaking tomorrow. When we first started the team 5 years ago, we wanted to make everything work. And what we realized, especially with a lot of the minority groups, was that you had to help them be successful. You had to help build them, just like some of the newer advocacy, disease-based advocacy groups. So you have to decide whether you personally have the time and the bandwidth to help those who have the same vision as you, but might not have the financial resources, the people resources, or the experience that you require to have a successful partnership. So it's okay to do that. You just have to set people up for success because you don't want to ultimately give them a reputation of not being able to do the job. So I'm going to move on to Nirmala, and I'm going to ask you, what are the ways that you've partnered with industry?
Sure. So what I recollect most vividly in first partnering with industry when I was my advocacy role is transparency. So when we would receive funding from pharmaceutical companies, we'd realize there wasn't a lot of transparency on the pharmaceutical side or on the advocacy side and what was being done with the money, what was being done as programmatically. So I decided to implement a report back, a communication loop. And what we did was simply call pharmaceutical representatives who funded us from the company, ask them twice a year to sit on a WebEx or a teleconference and say, we brought a patient into that as well. And we had the patient report how they attended the program that the money funded, what they learned from it, what they felt was lacking, and we decided that that worked. Pharmaceutical company really liked how that happened. They really liked the communication. They liked the loop that was created, that they gave us money to do something. Not only did we report back to them as they asked, but they also heard from the patient. Additionally, they had patients come to them and share their story internally. And so sharing the story, the power of patient storytelling internally for pharmaceutical companies helped motivate them to partner with advocacy groups. So that was the number one way I felt like was most important in starting that communication and relationship.
Thanks. So I actually have this question also. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump on something that was brought up several times earlier, which were some people call them advocacy boards, some call them focus groups. I call it Patient Engagement Network, or PEN. And so at Bristol-Myers Squibb, what my team has developed is for a new disease, a new asset, something complex, we create what's called a PEN, and it's a cohort of patients, caregivers, study coordinators with experience at sites for running diseases, running trials with those diseases, that usually the head of one or more advocacy groups, and our clinical teams, our FDT, our full development lead, which is an MD, our medical leads, our ops leads, our protocol managers, our site managers, my team, recruitment. We are all in a room together. This team comes together after first in human, and this cohort stays together until we're ready to file with a regulatory agency. This team is considered part of the clinical team, and it is treated like the clinical team. So as we go from protocol to protocol, asset to asset, they'll know the data, the interim data. They'll know how safety is looking. There isn't anything that they won't have available to them. As long as they're a member of the PEN, they can't be in a clinical trial. At any point, they can discontinue from the PEN and become a member of a clinical trial. Some of the things that I heard others say, our group, our PEN gets involved with. But a little earlier, I want the people in the PEN to help us design the synopsis. The protocol is way too late. So I want to know where the barriers are going to be long before my clinical colleagues start thinking up things that I used to think up when I was designing clinical trials. We have open dialogue. It has changed the way my clinical colleagues think about conducting clinical research. We, as a group, some of the people on the PEN go to investigator meetings. When it's time for the investigator meetings, they train the investigators. They invite the investigators to come to their support groups in their states, which they do. When they go to the support group meetings, we get patients the next week calling in to come and sign up for this study. People in the PEN have introduced us to 10, 20, 90 new investigators for Bristol-Myers Squibb. We co-create all of the patient-facing materials, all the site-facing materials together, and we have a virtual room, so when we're not together, it's available 24/7 so that we can ask questions or they can ask questions of us. And we started it at the disease area with multiple assets. My colleague in the back will be doing it across all tumor types in the next couple of months in pediatrics. And so we're going to start doing it even more different, in a more complex way, during the next couple of months. So that's one thing that I wanted to share. And then really quickly, I'm a big proponent of bringing people together that don't partner together. So I often bring together minority or community-focused groups with disease-focused groups. So, for example, the LFA, the NAACP's health group, and the NMA. And we come up with ways of partnering together. Their names go on all the materials together with ours. And we work the strategies and we get into the communities together. Once I leave, once Bristol-Myers Squibb leaves, these relationships continue without me. And so that's another thing that we do, which is really important to us. Is there anything that anyone would like to add? Okay. So the next question, Suzanne, maybe we can start with you, which is, what are some of the best practices or rules of engagement?
Yeah, this is. I wanted this question because it's a fun one. I think one of the most important things. I have two kind of top line ones. That one of the most important things is really trying to codify right up front how you're going to work together. And some of you might remember at PCORI we called this the research prenup. At the Arthritis Foundation, I'm working on a templated MOU or an LOA. That everyone gets, the patients who are going to be involved, we get it as the organization, our industry partner gets it, and it just lays out, this is what industry expects and what industry will do, this is what patients expect and what patients will do, this is what the organization expects, this is what the organization will do, and it sounds pretty simple, but it's amazing how many times you sort of fall into a relationship without negotiating or at least calling those things out up front, and I think it's just a really smart thing to do. And so we're trying to really make that just enterprise-wide practice for all of our partnership activities. The second thing is about preparation. We talk a lot about the need for training and upskilling, bidirectional. It's not just making patients more aware of how the clinical trial process works. It's also making investigators and clinicians more aware of being involved with patients. But specifically, one of the things we're building at the foundation is a series of modules and different ways to upskill patients. Because, yes, we are expert in our diseases. I'm expert in living with RA. But I'm not walking around with a PowerPoint in my back pocket that I'm ready to pull out at any moment. If you have a particular ask of patients or a group of patients, what we want to do is then prep them a little bit, talk through, this is what the ask is. Think through your entire, you know, in my case, 26 years of disease activity. What can you point to as some really good vignettes or really good examples that would help drive home what you want to communicate to this clinical trial team or to this panel of experts? Whatever the scenario is, what we want to do is maximize that impact. If it's engagement for the sake of just having people in the room and they're not necessarily sure what's going to happen and they're not ready to be there, then it's a lost opportunity. So we're really laser focused right now on this multimodal prep approach so that we can just tee it up and make the biggest impact possible.
And yeah, just to add to Suzanne's point, I think what's really missing also is measuring effectiveness and being transparent to one another. So pharmaceutical or industry needs to know what is effective for them, what's effective patient engagement, and what those metrics are. And so does patient advocacy organizations. They need to know what is considered effective, what is true patient engagement, and what is going to make this partnership beneficial to both of us, and letting that be known across the table. And I think that's where true collaboration happens.
I was just going to say, I love the idea, Suzanne, of having kind of prepping the investigators for what it's going to be like to work with patients or what the things might look like. With our project in particular, we the investigators or the folks from FDA and MDIC and MIT, we laid out what we thought was a very aggressive 18-month timeline, and we're like, this is cool, like this is moving lightning fast. And the patients look at it and they're like, why is it going to take so long? Like, can't we move this up a little faster? It's an important reality to think about. And I think our investigators, the investigators that weren't patients, weren't necessarily thinking about the fact that for us, while this looks like an aggressive timeline for the patients don't have time to waste. And so they are constantly pushing us to not only do better, but to be faster. And so I think that was kind of a anecdote we learned along the way, but I think really could be, it taught to the investigators up front.
Thank you, everyone. So, Lauren, how can industry better partner with patient groups?
I think we've already touched on so many things so far today on this panel and every other panel. I think engaging early and often is probably some of the best advice that I can possibly share. A few things that I want to pull from earlier conversations is the word partner, and really defining that very explicitly throughout the entire process, but then also understanding that both sides or all sides have things to gain. Also figuring out how to really kind of go bottom up. One of the many things that I really appreciate about working with MDIC is understanding and really listening to the patients from the very, very beginning, so letting them define what is important to them and what that trial then needs to reflect. I think so frequently there might be therapies or clinical trials that don't really address unmet needs of patients. Instead, they are what someone else has defined as important to a patient. So really understanding and getting that buy-in from the very beginning, and then continuously engaging throughout the entire clinical trial design process. And so making sure that the protocol is working, that the therapy that is being developed is going to actually be usable by a
certain population. There's so many examples of just kind of the science leading, whereas there can be a science to engaging patients and listening to patients, and everything that can be done can be evidence-based, and so not neglecting the patient and the humanity of the science and the ultimate end user of what it is that we're all trying to go towards. Also kind of as a trial progresses and goes towards approval, a project comes towards completion, figuring out how you're then going to share that back with the patient population, back with the industry through the approval process. So really educating patients that there might be something new out there for them, and engaging and educating providers that there might be something new out there, as well as engaging the payers to make sure that there's access to any therapies that might be out there. And so it's really just this iterative process, but making sure that lines of communication are open, and that there are those shared values and a true partnership and collaboration. Really looking at kind of that value framework throughout the entire process, and not just focusing on the cost, but the cost throughout the entire process as well.
So we have one last question, and Nirmala touched on it a little bit, and I'll come back and see if you have a couple extra things to say. The transparency and trust, especially when working with patient groups and or minority health groups or community groups, is really important, and it's probably one of the biggest questions that I get asked, especially working for a company that may have four assets in lupus today and then will have none for several years and then have a bolus again. It's just an example I'm using. And so people say, well, what do? You know, work with the ALR and the LRI and the LFA and then go away and helicopter back in when you need them? And the answer is no, absolutely not. So, and I would be shocked if anyone on my team behaved that way. I think that it is incumbent upon all of us to build and maintain relationships over time. And maintaining a relationship, even when you don't have a compound that's being looked at, means that you're still sitting at the table with others that are involved in the science, usually as part of an advocacy group's scientific roundtable. So you're participating, you're a paid member, you're involved, you're helping develop white papers, you're sharing your science. We do that in every area that we're involved in. My group does not give grants, but we make sure that the group that does continues to support all of the groups, regardless of whether we're there today or tomorrow. So once we build a relationship, it is maintained. And I believe that is vitally important. We never know when we're going to need more information. I'm not looking to have people hand me patients. That's not really what we're looking for. I think, you know, when I heard TJ say about the partnership, I agonized for about 10 minutes thinking, I don't know if that's a good description or a bad description, a name I should start using or one I should put away, because actually I call it partnerships. Now I'm thinking, I'm not comfortable with it. So I don't know, we have to have a discussion about that, because to me, as we're building trust, I thought, my feeling was that a partnership between these organizations with my organization was a good thing. So it's just something I thought I'd kind of share with everyone else, that I'm a little bit perplexed by that whole thing. So the one thing that I'll never forget that was said to me by a group that really everybody could work with and should work with is they listed the names of the companies that they'll no longer work with. And I said, why not? And they said, they helicoptered in and helicoptered out. I had never heard that phrase. And I said, could you teach me what that phrase meant? And they said, they came in when they needed patients, and then they left. We've never heard from them again. And so I said to them, I promise I will never do that to you. And that was almost 5 years ago. So I think that you have one opportunity to blow your credibility, one opportunity to break a promise, one opportunity to not step up to the relationship. And I think that when it comes to working with patients and patient groups, That's our job in patient engagement when working in industry, right? We have to lead the way, set the example, and we have to show, we're the ones who have to show the integrity and let the others in our companies follow behind because we're setting the standard. So with that, Nirmala, do you have anything to add?
I think you touched on it earlier about the authenticity and having the staff to be able to commit to that deliverable, right? As an from an industry side, you want to be able to maintain that partnership. You want to be able to keep that communication ongoing, as you said. But if you know that truthfully you don't have the time committed, then don't commit to that partnership and leave the communication open and say, we can't do this now, but we can do this down the road when we have the staff to help and create this partnership. As I said, working on the advocacy side, it was exactly that. When you came, there was patience, there was a need, there was something that needed to be fulfilled, and then that was that. Mm-hmm. And that broke the trust down, not only from the advocacy perspective, but the patients that we were working with. And we lost credibility as an advocacy organization because we're supposed to be looking and safeguarding for the patient's perspective. So if there's anything that I can add to that, it's really, if you're going to build this partnership, build the infrastructure, build the culture that supports it, and then bring patient advocacy organizations into that culture.
Thank you. So here's part two to the day, or at least to our part of the day. We have two questions that we can ask the audience, but we, as a group, would prefer if you asked us questions, but if nobody goes up to a microphone, then we're going to test you.
I'm going to spare the audience. So, I have a question. There have been a lot of articles recently, one even yesterday on Reuters, about patient advocacy ties with industry groups, and this seems to be like the new hot area of inquiry, the way HCPs were previously. And I personally am very concerned. I think it would be very problematic if now, you know, industry is afraid to contribute to advocacy groups, and then what happens to advocacy groups if they're not getting industry funding? And I think we all know in this room that you have your bylaws, you're protecting yourself, but then what can we do in terms of best practices and together overall to kind of stop this tide? Because, you know, I had even my CCO send me this article like, oh, what are we doing? So, yeah, I want to hear your thoughts.
I mean, you're asking like the $10,000 question. So the very first thing that our team did when we, because there were no benchmarks, we couldn't find another company that had a group like ours. If they existed, we didn't know about it. So Mary, I keep mentioning her name, worked with our legal staff to create a guidance document. And the guidance document basically tells us what we can do, what we can't do, and there's a line of demarcation between us and the grants team and us and the commercial advocacy team. So we're not involved in grants. So then you say, Lori, where's your funding? Do you have any money? And I look at you and I smile charmingly and say, no, I have no money. And we used to call ourselves the two broke girls until we hired a few more associate directors. I was the dark-haired one. She was the blonde. Turns out it's gray, but I thought it was blonde. And so we've never had a budget. It's been 5 years. So how do you help an advocacy or a patient group that you're partnering with? And the answer is we're in clinical trials. And so we create a strategy for every disease area, every therapeutic area, every drug program, and every drug protocol or study protocol. And that money comes out of our clinical trial grant. So we have to work with our operations team and our recruitment team, and we pay our advocacy groups as if they're a vendor, and these are tactics. And that's how it's done. And it's very clear, so we pay them fair market value, and it's part of the overall strategy. We've been doing it for 5 years. Now, if somebody comes to me, we heard about the LFA this morning from Marla, so I've been working with Sandra Raymond at the LFA for years, and you know, and she's done tactics with me when we had a campaign for lupus nephritis. And you know, we worked on the tactics together. It got paid through the clinical trial budget. But when she wanted support for a walk or if she wanted support for education, you have to go apply through the BMS Grant Foundation, not through me. I don't even want to discuss it with you. So it's a very separate animal. The problem is that the media, or even many, many advocacy groups and others, don't understand that process. And so once people begin to understand it or figure it out or ask those of us who are doing it successfully, we don't even have to go through legal to the degree that we used to have to over the first 1 or 2 years, because even though we're with a very conservative company, this is almost like blinking or breathing. It's that simple now. So that's hopefully that's helpful.
I want to jump in. I'm going to put my lawyering skills to work and answer your question by not answering it and pivoting to a slightly different topic. Because one of the things that indirectly gets at this issue is, and it really speaks to the transparency and trust piece, we're grown-ups, and so we don't want to get in scenarios where we don't feel like we're in charge of our part of the relationship. And so when I talked about that MOU and laying out in advance what we want to do and how we want to do it and what we expect from you and what you expect from us, a lot of that speaks to legitimacy. And if someone came to us and said, hey, can you give us 10 patients to review a clinical trial protocol? It's too late to make changes, but we'd love for you to just review it. Well, we're going to say no to that because we're sophisticated and we want to do this in a way that we feel comfortable. So I think it's, again, not an answer directly to your question, but we're really approaching this like we're going to be sophisticated partners. And we're going to codify it, and we're going to deal with each other in very upfront, transparent, trustworthy ways. So that's my non-answer.
No, that's a good answer.
I think also to play off of that, it's a very symbiotic relationship. I'm not sure if one can really exist without the other. And so I think understanding and respecting the value that each can bring to the relationship and to that partnership, sorry, I do like that word. I think that you just have to figure out like how you're going to define where those lines are and how you can exchange information in order to work together towards an ultimate goal.
Just to add more to the fire, I guess, I think a lot of onus has been put on industry, but from the patient perspective and the patient advocacy perspective, I don't feel like advocacy groups have, within therapeutic areas, have been collaborating effectively, or they're resting on their laurels of being a patient advocacy organization, and they're not coming together and saying, let's limit redundancy across the therapeutic area, because it makes it difficult for industry to say that I'm working with X organization in breast cancer and not Y organization in breast cancer, and so money is going here and not here, and that creates this mystery and air of not being transparent and funding and money and all of that. But if the therapeutic areas and the advocacy groups within them came together a little bit more, worked more collaboratively, and made it a bit easier for industry to help work with them collectively, I think that transparent air would build upon that.
So I see Ken hovering to my left. Do we have time for one more? Is there one more question, or do you want us to ask you one? Okay, so, all right, let's see. Which one do you think is harder, Lauren? Question one or question two? Let's pick the harder one.
Yeah.
Which one?
Number two.
Okay, number two it is. What are some of the pitfalls to avoid, TJ, when partnering? Yeah, but I'm using the word. So what are some of the pitfalls to avoid when partnering? Has anyone had a pitfall that they'd like to avoid and they might want to help other people avoid, either on the side of advocacy or industry or somewhere in between?
I guess if nobody else answers, I will answer. Pitfalls are not recognizing the other party's intent. What they're trying to get out of the relationship. I think it's like any relationship you're in, that we all come to this with a with something that we want to get out of it. As a patient, I want to get better. As industry, you want to be able to put a product to market. So recognizing that there are different drivers for each of us in there and respecting those and saying that this is important to me, and I recognize that what you're trying to do is important to you as well. So how do we get there together? Anybody else?
I see a question in the back by a man with a suit.
Sorry. I cracked myself up there.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. It's better than saying the young man with no hair, so thank you. Appreciate that. So I would say a pitfall, interestingly, is sort of not knowing about the transparency. So it was interesting, I think, it's Lori on the end, when you were talking about BMS and sort of how patient groups get paid. And so I've seen where patients are being paid or patient groups are being paid, and then they're sort of pushing something from a pharma company, but you don't know there's that relationship. And so all of a sudden, both sides lose extreme credibility when people find out. And I've seen it happen firsthand. So it's almost like the patient group acts as a mouthpiece for the pharmaceutical agencies and vice versa, and nobody knows there's anything transpiring. And I know medical device companies and pharma companies that do it, that definitely don't disclose it. And so you really have no idea, and then all trust is lost. That's a big one to avoid. I've seen it bad fallout.
That's a great point. Thank you. So I personally would like to thank everybody on the panel. You made it fun, and I'm really glad I got to meet each of you. So thank you.
The Patients as Partners program was designed out of the Disruptive Innovations to Advance Clinical Trials Conference with the intent to better incorporate the patient's voice and improve the patient's experience throughout the entire clinical trial continuum. For more information, visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for joining us.